Another mass shooting in a school, this one much closer to home. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through the app. Just ahead, we'll go live to South Florida and have the latest information after the tragedy at a South Florida high school, and we want your calls, too, at 549-2937. Then later, it's interesting to see that here in Jacksonville, a medical marijuana registry is doing brisk business. We'll tell you about it. Street artist Banksy's work is being exhibited in the city as well. That and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, for the 18th time since the beginning of this year, gunfire has erupted at a school in the United States. 17 people are confirmed dead after 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz allegedly opened fire on his fellow students and teachers at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland in South Florida yesterday. It is the highest number of fatalities at a school shooting since Sandy Hook in Connecticut. Now, we are learning more about the 19-year-old shooter this morning and what the kids in that school endured. Also, the state legislature is in session right now, and we've learned that Florida's Senate and House are split on whether to kick in any more money for safe schools, the pot of funds that deals with school security. We'll talk about that, too. And also, it's a tragic reality that in today's America, kids and teachers in schools are trained to deal with active shooter situations. So are managers in workplaces and medical response personnel. We'll talk about all that, too. But first, we're going to go to South Florida, and WLRN Miami reporter Katie Sitwalski, she was on the scene yesterday. She's now at Pine Trails Park near the school where grief counseling is underway for the students. She's on the line for us. Katie, good morning. Thanks for being with us. And so you are at a park near the school. What's happening there?
Very somber scene this morning. Groups of high schoolers are trickling in, groups of friends. Parents are bringing their kids in this morning. Some parents are coming in for counseling. But the American Red Cross has a disaster relief van here. They're bringing counselors in. They're helping people cope inside. Lots of tears. It's very quiet here.
And we were able to look at the social media video that so many of the students inside that high school posted yesterday during the ordeal, during the violence, unbelievable trauma that these children have endured. And so to see that the Red Cross is there as though it's the aftermath of a war zone is simply, this is the reality of America today, that children in high schools are being trained regularly on how to deal with active shooter situations.
Absolutely. It is like a war zone for a lot of these kids. I mean, if they didn't know one of the people that were injured or killed in this tragedy, then they certainly heard the gunfire. All the students I've talked to heard it, and getting to communicate with their parents is very frantic. Some had to leave their cell phones behind. Students who left belongings behind were told to come back to the school this morning at 8 a.m. to retrieve it, things like backpacks, books, cell phones. And it's, you know, even if you weren't directly impacted by the shooter's action, you are absolutely affected.
We're hearing that there were heroic efforts by some of the teachers and perhaps a coach to shield some of the kids. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is. That's what's coming in. And this coach, you know, everybody here is saying, you know, that is absolutely characteristic of this man. He died as he lived.
And can you tell me as well, you know, this is a situation that schools across the state, and we're going to talk more about this on this program, schools across the state have struggled with funding for school security. Have you heard anything from school officials down there in South Florida about that in terms of funding they had for school resource officers and what the security situation is at Parkland?
I haven't heard specifics on if they'll change the security measures. I do know that Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School is a very open campus, very large, more than 3,000 students. And it was very easy for this one person to blend in. I mean, he was young. He looked like a student. and he sort of just ran into the crowd. So in terms of security, I think what's next, the state will decide after it covers the cost for the funerals of these 17 victims.
Tell me a little bit more, too, about Nicholas Cruz as detectives dig into his past. No previous arrests, but certainly he had displayed plenty of troubling behavior before he allegedly fatally opened fire on 17 people. A troubled teen, according to his social media post, few
yes,
friends,
that's right.
Obsessive interest in weapons, and illegally obtained what appears to be an AR-15 assault-style rifle to carry out this attack. What have we learned so far about Nicholas Cruz and how he obtained the weapon?
We don't know how he obtained the weapon yet, but we do know his adopted mother just passed away in November. So he was pretty depressed after the death of his mother and living with friends and their parents. The parents of that friend say they never thought, you know, he would be violent. He's had a history of violence, like you said, on social media, and the FBI was tipped off to his behavior back in September when a YouTuber saw a comment that Cruz had left on a video and about shooting schools. And so that YouTuber had sent tips to enforcement.
All right. She's Katie Swodolski with WLRN in Miami on the phone from a park near the school where the shootings occurred, where grief counselors and the Red Cross are on site. Katie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll go to your calls as we discuss the school shooting in South Florida in just a moment at 549-2937. It is a tragic reality that in today's America, kids and teachers in schools are trained to deal with active shooter situations. So are managers in all of our workplaces. So are medical response personnel, like the heroes of this city's own Trauma One. I'm sad to say that a regular guest on this program is Chad McIntyre, manager, Trauma One Flight Services at UF Health Jacksonville Medical Center. The reason for that is Chad is the expert in this community at talking about how medical personnel deal with the triage of a mass shooting. Hi, Chad. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa. It's always good to see you, but unfortunate it's under these circumstances.
That's right. And so you were one of the first people that came to my mind yesterday because, of course, when something like this happens, a trauma center is immediately mobilized and injured people start flooding in and you have to manage that and you have to try to save as many lives as possible as fast as possible. And the damage that an assault-style weapon can do to the human body is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, these assault rifles can unload thousands of rounds in a matter of minutes. And what we know from studies from the FBI is that most of these incidents are going to be done in about 5 minutes or less. The greatest percentage of those are going to be done in 2 minutes, but those are mass number of people. In our trauma center at UF Health Jacksonville, along with Trauma One and all of our first responders are trained to respond to these, but we're responding to too many of these, and it's getting to be what we really need to start calling what it is an epidemic in our society.
You have advocated for a long time, as have, let's be clear, the American Medical Association and other medical advocacy groups, to get beyond the politics of this and start talking about this in terms of what it really is, which is a public health emergency.
Yeah, you know, the American College of Surgeons, the American Medical Association, the National Association of Police Chiefs, everyone has come together and said that these type of weapons do not belong on our streets. More importantly, I think we have to start addressing this as we have over the decades, like we did in the 70s with people dying in their cars. We made cars safer, like we did with the HIV and AIDS epidemic in the 80s, the drug use in the 90s, terrorism in the 2000s. Whenever these happened, we responded. But for whatever reason, we have failed to respond to numbers of people that continue to die due to gun violence. And the immediate aftermath, we immediately go to our corners and draw a line and are unable to even have the discussion of where do we want to go. Is it school funding for resource officers? Is it mental health funding? Is it gun gun buying and background reform. We can't even have the talks.
That is the tragedy, and that is the paralysis of where this country is. And what is so tragic about it is that the U.S. stands alone among developed nations when it comes to this level of gun violence. We are simply alone in the world. No other Western industrialized nation has this level of consistent, deadly gun violence.
No, we actually, if you look at the next 10 developed countries combined, we have more gun violence in our country in a year than they have combined in the last 10. And those are developed countries that when you add up the numbers of people, and we cannot continue to say that it's all just mental illness, because less than 5% of these people had actual diagnosed mental illness. And we can't pretend that we have more mentally ill people in our country than others. There is one problem that we all have to come to deal with, and that is the availability of guns in our society and an inability for us to have a good talk and debate on an intellectual level of how we're going to address it. And I'm not able to say that the answer is this or the answer is that, but until we have the discussion, we're never going to be able to find it and bring in those experts. And until then, I guess I'll continue to train people how to respond, how to stop bleeding, and how to get out of an active shooter, because I don't know the other answer.
That's what you do. Can you?
Yes, ma'am.
You've talked about this on this show many times. You're the manager of Trauma One Flight Services at UF Health Jacksonville Medical Center. Trauma One, the only level one trauma facility anywhere for miles around. If someone gets shot in this community, if they're in a really bad car accident, if they get really hurt badly, they're going to be taken to you as fast as possible. If they have a stroke, Trauma One is an absolutely critical lifeline. And so what you do there is so vitally important. Tell our listeners about how you manage these situations. You just said, stop the bleed, active shooter situation. These are phrases that you have to say all the time. These are protocols that you've had to teach over and over again.
So, you know, I can honestly tell you that when I started my career 25 years ago, I didn't know the word active shooter. We didn't talk about training the public to do tourniquets. We used to set up, and even in Sandy Hook, we would set up a staging area outside while the event was controlled. And we've had to change all that. And working with our community partners in fire rescue and other hospitals, Trauma One Flight Services and UF Health Jacksonville, we go out and we train the public on how to stop the bleed when these things happen. Use a tourniquet, put direct pressure. The life you may save may be your own. Get out of there. We train people how to hide, run, fight. And of course, you know, we train our EMS personnel and our first responders. And I have to give credit to the police and fire yesterday down in Broward County. They had a 3-minute response time. Our old days of staging outside and trying to get an assessment, they immediately entered. And I think that's really why the carnage was not worse than what it was. They did a great job down there. And I believe in our area with our training and our partners that we would do the same.
Let's go to a few calls now for Chad McIntyre, manager of Trauma One, as we talk about what happened yesterday in South Florida. We'll go to your comments on social media in just a moment. 549-2937. Chuck is at the beaches right now. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, guys. This is a very emotional issue, and so I'll try to just stick to a couple basic, simple points. I was an NRA firearms instructor, two security licenses. Senator Nelson said this morning that he doesn't want the schools to be armed camps. We know that there are serious threats at all of the schools. The school officer who was shot down there met the shooter. He was a security person there. He had no firearm. The only way you will stop a person who has a handgun or a firearm is with a firearm. So you mentioned the school officer, resource officers. If we put school resource officers in the school, which we already have them now, but they're not armed, and we arm them, then they will be like police officers. They will be able to meet people who have intent, ability, and are trying to hurt you. They'll be able to stop them. If you don't have a firearm, the same thing will happen that happened there. That security officer, had he had a firearm, is a high likelihood he could have stopped that shooter. Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck.
So, Chuck, I just want to say one thing real quick, and one of the things I do appreciate the fact that you're teaching in responsible gun ownership and gun use is to also remember that the FBI has really looked at a lot of these, and unfortunately, I study most of these active shooter events, and they're going to be done in about 3.5 to 5 minutes. And while you, as an experienced gun owner, are going to be able to react quickly and be able to understand what's happening in the situation, unless you are really trained to know what's going on, to be able to pick out the perpetrator and to be able to fire well, then that may not be the answer. And I'm not saying that we should not arm those people, but more guns in the area for people to be able to have and quickly react in 3.5-4 minutes. I don't know that everybody is going to be able to respond that way. Secondarily, is we also know from the FBI information of active shooters is really the confrontation to the shooter. It doesn't even matter if they are armed or with a chair or with a book. In almost all those cases, the shooter will shoot themselves, or they will flee, or they will stop the shooting.
Well, then what conclusions did the FBI draw, or what recommendations did they make when they analyzed active shooter situations and said that having another weapon on the school site wouldn't help? What did they recommend?
So the FBI report that came out in 2010 and then it was subsequently updated in 2015, and everybody can find that on the FBI website, go to their active shooter response plan. It doesn't really come to this is how we believe you should respond. It just kind of gives the facts. It's about a 200-and-some page document, but there's some good graphs in there. But one of the things is obviously run, get away. But if you can't hide somewhere. And if you can't hide and you have to attack, then go at them with anything, a chair, a book, and just go after them.
I know, though, that how many times are we going to have this conversation?
We're going to keep having this conversation until we actually do something. We'll have it next week, and we'll have it the week after.
How many times are we going to keep this? I have been covering this for how many decades now? And this is the ritual, a mass shooting. Terrified kids, grieving parents. People say they are offering thoughts and prayers. Then they are lambasted for throwing out that phrase. Empty words. Each side retreats to their partisan corner. And no measurable progress on reducing the number of gun violence-related deaths in this country. And so, quite frankly, I think most Americans, wherever they stand politically, are tired of this. Very, very tired.
I hope they are. I hope so. I know that I am.
Jason in San Marco. Go ahead, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa. I appreciate your opportunity to let me speak. I'm old enough to remember the time when schools didn't have to have armed guards at them. I went to elementary school in the 70s, and I guess Chuck, who is a very well-informed and consistent contributor to your show, is comfortable sleeping at night knowing that we can just put armed, SWAT teams or SWAT individuals in front of our schools. I think that's an incredibly sad legacy to leave to our children. I don't know the answer to this problem, but I'm convinced that when the people who want to see common sense, bipartisan gun legislation introduced and passed in Congress outwork the NRA and the no gun control lobby, that you'll see action. And my suggestion is that you give out the phone numbers of Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio, and you suggest that callers and listeners look up their representatives' phone numbers and that they call every day. And they call every day, and they call every day, and they don't stop calling and leaving messages until action is taken. I'm convinced that if 30 million Americans, who I think is at least the minimum number of people who want to see common sense, bipartisan gun legislation introduced and passed, take action on a consistent basis, you will see action in Congress. Until then, the simple fact of the matter is that the gun lobby and the NRA outwork the people that want to see common sense, bipartisan gun legislation. They hold sway in Congress. The NRA is who I'm talking about. And until that changes, you're not really going to see even any attempt to find a solution to the problem. I mean, I want to tell you, I don't know what the answer is. There's too many assault weapons in this nation. Your in-studio guest made a point that we have 10 times the violent gun death, as in, pardon me, more violent gun death than the next 10 industrialized nations combined. And I wonder if there's a correlation, because we also spend more on military and weapons than the next 17 nations combined on an annual basis. So I really appreciate you giving me a chance to give you my opinion, and I hope that you have a safe day.
Yeah, I hope we all do. Thanks, Jason.
So, you know, Jason, one of the things I did want to respond, that you clearly have a passion for what your beliefs are and how we would address this. And meeting with just those two callers, Melissa, if we had Jason, who's very passionate in what he believes but was able to articulate that well, and so did Jason, is that that doesn't happen in Tallahassee right now, and that doesn't happen in Washington, D.C.
Exactly right.
Is if two people that have opposing views could actually say, I heard you, and this is what I think. But those two things aren't happening, and I think that's what the breakdown is.
On our First Coast Connect Facebook page, Doug writes, to all the people saying school systems should put more armed police officers in the schools, where is that money going to come from? And as I pointed out a moment ago, the Safe School pot of money in Florida has been going down every year since the recession. It's down to, I think, about $60 million. It pays for resource officers who, as Chuck the caller pointed out, are not typically armed. Schools have been asking for more money for school security and haven't been getting it in Florida. Diane writes, this kid was on everyone's radar. Nothing was done. He got his hands on an assault-style rifle. Nothing was done. He was all over social media with crazy postings. Nothing was done. Pepper emails the show, what do I tell my daughter if there's an active shooter at her school? I need to give her information. That's all I think any parent is thinking. What if it's my kid? What if? How do I know my kid's going to come home from their school alive? That is what every parent is thinking.
And that's sad. You know, it is, Melissa, you and I were talking earlier back in when we were younger, we used to train for tornado drills in our school. We used to do the duck and hide under our desk for nuclear. And now we're actually training and talking to our children about, if there's a shooting that happens in the school, this is what you need to do. And that's a sad reality that we face. I would like for every parent, however, no matter where you stand on gun laws, where you stand on this epidemic that's happening in our country, is to sit down with your children and say, we need to have a discussion. If there's an emergency in your school, this is what I need you to do. This is where I need you to go. And you need to have it over and over and over.
And what should they tell them?
So first of all is, if there is a shooting going on, follow the direction of their teacher. Most of the time, the teacher is going to probably lock that door and you're going to hide. There was one report yesterday out of Parkland where there was 15 kids hiding in a classroom closet. They were hiding behind desks. When the shooter's coming by, if they don't see anybody, they're going to keep on going. So hide. If you're in a public space, run. Run, drop everything. Put your hands in the air because the police are coming. Don't take your backpack. Hands in the air. Run, run, run. If you can't run, hide. If you can't hide, then whoever the biggest football player in the room might have to fight. And that's the last thing that we want to talk about, but that may be where we come to.
John is on the line in Jacksonville. John, good morning. John, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello. Okay, I couldn't tell I was on the air. Just want to make a couple points. You can't disarm everyone in America. Number two, criminals will always acquire arms and means to hurt people. And also, let me just point out, there are people spend money. They have an armed guard when you go and pick up a bag of money from a grocery store. There's an armed guard at Tiffany's at the town center, and there's armed guards at most banks. Politicians have armed guards. The president has multiple armed guards. When are we going to wake up and spend the money to protect the children? Or, short of that, I'm sure there's many people that would volunteer to protect the schools. So that's an immediate solution.
Yeah, thank you, John.
So, Jason,
thanks, John.
I'm sorry, Melissa. A couple points is that, yes, Tiffany's and politicians and banks, they do have armed guards, but remember, they're guarding a property, essentially. And we're talking about guarding a campus that is very large with two schools on it and some small portables of 3,000 people. And that's going to take a lot of money if you want to do that all over the state. And you're right that people that want to commit crime, they will, whether it's with a handgun, whether it's with a knife. But when you have an assault rifle that can fire off 8 rounds every second, that is not the same as a handgun when you're talking about the number of fatalities and how you're going to actually be able to intervene when we know that these are going to be done in 3 to 5 minutes.
What about his comment, though, that these are children that are being gunned down at their school, which for hundreds of years in this country, we have had the expectation that our kids are safe at their school. We no longer can assume that.
No, and I don't think you should assume that your child or yourself or your partner is safe anywhere, whether it's a restaurant, whether it is a movie theater, the library, or a school. And I'm not saying that to make cause fear. I'm saying it because it's fact. And we can go back and we can actually log out where these have happened in the last 10 years in all of those locations. And something has to be done. And it's not, again, it's not fear-mongering. It's the fact that this is where we are, and we just have to come to that reality, either change it or live with it.
And let's bring it back to where we started.
Yes, ma'am.
Which is, you're a medical professional. You're the manager of Trauma One Flight Services at UF Health, Jax. You have been consistent all along, as has the American Medical Association and other medical advocacy groups, that in order for this country to meaningfully address this problem, we need to redefine it as a public health emergency.
When it's a public health emergency, it brings all health professionals and resources to bear. Currently, the Centers for Disease Control is prohibited from actually studying gun violence because they don't want they keep fighting against what that actually looks like. If we don't study what it looks like, there's no way we're going to be able to solve it. We didn't do that with cancer. We haven't done that with heart disease. We haven't done that with car accidents. It's the only thing that we don't even know how to begin to start addressing the problem because we're not even looking at it.
Chad McIntyre, manager of Trauma One Flight Services at UF Health. Thank you.
Melissa, it's always good to see you, and hopefully next time it's not in these circumstances.
That's right. That's right. We'll be right back.
Because other people don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. My next snap judgment from WNYC, The Path. Snap judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Saturdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state
about the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, vocalist Cecile McLaurin-Sylvant and pianist Sullivan Fortner live in concert at Jazz and Lincoln Center and in conversation in Harlem. The intimacy of two of the most charming new voices in jazz. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
I know you inside out. You ain't no eagle.
Welcome back. After Florida approved the use of medical marijuana, physician groups around the state responded to meet the need. One of them is here in Jacksonville. Daniel Locke is with Medical Marijuana Physician Group, Compassionate Alternative Care, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. Of course, this is legal now for a number of conditions, cancer, HIV and AIDS, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease. Your physician group is responding to this. Tell me about the practice.
Well, we saw the need in the industry, and I did a lot of research, and actually a couple of people that I knew were giving me some feedback on how wonderful it had been for them to get off the opioids, and I knew that at some point, people are going to start responding, trying to get off the opioids and take care of the chronic pain.
This is, you think, a way for people to transition off opioids, which is an epidemic in this country.
Yes,
medical
ma'am.
Marijuana.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I hear the stories every day. I'm so blessed to get to hear these patient stories, and they're all very similar sometimes.
How does it work? How do people come to you and get this medication?
Well, first thing they'll do is, they'll pick up phone, give us a call and say, "Hey, I want to get a medical marijuana card." That's sort of how it goes. And then what I tell them is, do you have one of the conditions that the state says qualifies you? Okay? And if the answer is yes, then my next question is, "Have you seen a physician for this condition within the last year?" Well, if you have, then what I ask you to do is come in, fill out a medical release form. I'm going to submit that to your current physician. Once we verify that you have that condition, then I'll make you an appointment with one of our physicians.
Right. And so what would you say to those who are worried about abuse of the system and abuse of the medication you're prescribing?
I'd tell them that the real gateway drug to the abuse is opioids.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
We don't need to go into that, but there has been no cases of somebody overdosing on medical marijuana. There's been no cases of somebody graduating. You know, we were conditioned back in the 80s, it's the gateway drug.
Yeah.
It is absolutely the opposite of the gateway drug.
How do people take it? Do you give it to them in pill form, tincture form?
Good question. Yeah, there are multiple ways in the state of Florida. Different states have different rules. In the state of Florida, the majority of folks are vaping, okay? Just because that's something that just so you can vape, you can take pills, you can take oils, and actually edibles have been approved, which will be out next month.
And the number of practices like yours are springing up. This is booming across the state now, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am. If you look, there's just a handful, 8 or 10 of them here in Jacksonville. I think there's one physician maybe in St. Augustine, then the next one's all the way down in Daytona. But in South Florida, where the older population is, that's where it's more predominant. The average age of a medical marijuana card holder is 58 years old.
They're graybeards.
That's exactly right. the retirement community down in was it outside of Ocala?
Uh-huh.
Oh my goodness, the dispensaries are wrapped around
all around the villages, huh?
The villages. Thank you.
Yeah. Not what you might expect. So people, I think, have so much interest in this.
Yes, ma'am.
And people might not realize that there is a practice right here in Jacksonville. You are just west of downtown, correct?
Correct. We're right off of Beaver Street and the Beaver Street Enterprise Center. So we, thought we would kill two birds with one stone, help, they had startup businesses there, and they've been fabulous for us.
Now, it's fair to say the legislature was not a big fan of this becoming the law.
Correct.
But since it's become law, have you had any hiccups or red tape, in setting up this business?
No, ma'am. I mean, I wouldn't have done it had I not hooked up with a lady down south who's actually our consultant, and she's consulting about 180 physicians throughout the state. And we're just all following the same drum, same consistency. And that's, you don't feel like a lone ranger out there trying to get it accomplished.
Which patients are seeing, Daniel, the most success with medical marijuana? Out of all these conditions that you prescribe for, you know, Crohn's disease, Parkinson's, epilepsy, cancer, this whole list, mm-hmm. which patients see the most success?
Well, anybody with chronic pain, believe it or okay. not. I mean, the way the law is written, it's one of those conditions or something that is associated with it. You know, for example, fibromyalgia. We're seeing so many women with fibromyalgia that are getting off the Lyrica and all these harsh drugs. And something that most folks don't know, CBD is non-mind altering. So here in the state of Florida, we have THC and we have CBD. Okay, so somebody who's older who says, you know, I never experimented with that stuff in the 60s, we start them with CBD and they get the benefits without the head high that comes with, you know, the THC.
You can learn more at Daniel's website. He's with Medical Marijuana Physician Group in Jacksonville. The website, compaltcare.com. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I really appreciate you.
Later in the hour, street artist Banksy's work is being exhibited in Jacksonville. But up next, the local industry that's booming, craft beer. We'll be right back.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc and the next Zorba Pastor on your health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
delicious banana pudding.
We always have a great time, so will you, on Zorba Pastor on your health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. The local craft beer industry started about 10 years ago in this area and has seen steady growth ever since. Last year, the foam crested right over the top of this business, with several new breweries opening up. Tim Gibbons is editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal, and he's got a story about this in this week's JBJ. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So lots of these just popped up in the last couple of years.
It has. It's really interesting. So, you know, it's been a decade since craft breweries opened on the First Coast. Bold City was the first one. Mm-hmm. So we decided to take a look at, it's been a decade. How is that doing as a business? The thing that we found really fascinating as we actually delved into the numbers behind it is how much it's exploded recently. So there's 21 licensed breweries on the First Coast right now. Seven of them, a full third, opened up in the past year.
And why do you think that is?
It's interesting in talking to some of the experts. Part of it is just kind of this national trend of more interest. But specifically, there's a sense that Jacksonville is kind of on this momentum upswing sort of thing, that it's not there's a lot of potential for more interest. People like this locally made sort of thing.
Locally made products are great, and a brewery is a great business for a number of reasons. People see the potential. Why?
It actually can be transformative for a neighborhood. One of the fascinating things when you dig into the data itself is looking at where they locate. So you have, you know, Fishweir is a brewery focused on sour beers that is looking to open in San Marco. on Main Street in Springfield, you have Main and Six and Hyperion and Strings are three breweries. Two of them are open. Strings is going to open later this year. Both of those, San Marco and Springfield, obviously are these kind of up-and-coming neighborhoods that benefit from having these commercial operations move in and give a sense of place to where they're going into.
A lot of breweries start small and local, and then they kind of blow up, don't they, and become national. Do you see any local microbreweries in this community having that potential?
There are a couple who are definitely trying to grow, yeah. You know, on both a regional and national scale. That's one of the interesting things in the life cycle of a developing craft brew scene is you have the first ones. You look at Intuition, you look at Bold City, who have their tap rooms, but also have started canning, have started distributing both here in Jacksonville and on a regional basis. Some of the new breweries coming in are not trying to do that yet. Their idea is they come in and they're basically focused on their own small operation serving a neighborhood. Talking to some national experts on craft brewery, it turns out that's kind of how the industry develops, that you have some big players, but to truly have the number of breweries that a Portland has or an Asheville, North Carolina, not all of them distribute. Many of them end up just serving a neighborhood or maybe a city because that's all that they can actually, bear.
Do you see Jacksonville going the route of Asheville, North Carolina or Portland? Are we going to see that many breweries? How many do we have now total?
We have 21 licenses.
21.
So it's about 19, breweries because there's multiple locations. If you talk to those in the craft brewing scene, they would tell you, yes, of course, we can be in Asheville or Portland, particularly if they've had some of their product. But the general thing, optimistically, maybe not a Portland, but definitely a Tampa. Tampa is the kind of main city in Florida for craft beers. And you talk to many people in the scene here and they say, absolutely, we can be on that path. Portland has a culture, Asheville, North Carolina has a culture that definitely allows more of that. From the economic impact, though, one of the interesting things is this is not just serving people here locally. You talk to tourist development people, there is definitely people coming from outside the area to here, just like they do in North Carolina, where it's attracting more interest, where it's becoming a draw for the city. And that actually obviously opens up the potential for more of these breweries.
So Visit Jacksonville is loving this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what about the local ale trail?
That has actually done surprisingly well.
It's called the First Coast Ale Trail,
It's the First
right?
Coast Ale Trail. Yeah. I believe there's 8 of the breweries are on it. They probably will be updating that at some point, but their statistics do show a high number of people coming from outside the area doing this kind of pub crawl sort of thing, as well, obviously, as locals who want something to do on a Saturday afternoon.
What's your favorite brewery? I'm going to get you in trouble now.
Many of them.
You're so diplomatic.
I am interested in Fishware opening up because I do like the sour beers, but Aardwolf has some amazing beers. Intuition, Bold City have just been doing great stuff for a long time. Main and Six has some great stuff.
I've heard you've been spotted at Shantytown now and again too.
Not that's
a microbrewery.
Occasionally.
He's Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. You can read about the growth of breweries on the First Coast in their edition this week. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
A quick break, and in a moment, he's the top street artist in the world. Find out where you can see the work of Banksy being exhibited. A $2 million piece of original Banksy art, that is, being exhibited in Jacksonville. That's in a moment. We'll be right back.
Can I take this?
Yeah.
Baltimore has a problem with cops and robbers. Some of the cops are robbers, too. The latest scandal exposed officers acting like a gang, stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from drug dealers and keeping the cash. We'll speak to former Baltimore police officer Michael Wood about fighting crime and corruption in Charm City. Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
The bloodthirsty cartel known as MS-13 has infiltrated our schools
On the next Fresh Air, we look at President Trump's anti-immigration policies and how he's used MS-13 to justify them. We'll discuss what MS-13 is and how it was formed. Our guest will be Jonathan Blitzer, a New Yorker staff writer who covers immigration. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Coming up on the next Reveal, Tennessee Watson was sexually molested as a kid. Decades later, she told the police about the man who abused her.
He isn't isolated, but he does still work with young people.
But getting justice wasn't easy.
Really, the prosecutor is the linchpin. The buck stops with him. He can reject a case just because he doesn't want to do it.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Google is trying to make the ads it serves up to us better, less annoying, but there is some risk.
Who's to say that next month a product representing millions of dollars of investment won't be banned the day after its release?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Automatic ad blocking, good news or not so much? We'll tell you next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, this is an incredible piece of news for art lovers. The top street artist in the world, Banksy, is coming to town. His work, that is. A $2 million piece of original Banksy art will be on display at the downtown Main Library through the middle of March. This is an incredible opportunity to see some incredible work. Here with more, we're pleased to welcome Brian Greif. He is executive producer of the film Saving Banksy, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
And it's my understanding that this piece is called Hate Street Rat. It will be in the Jack's Makerspace Gallery at the Main Library, worth $2 million. It was taken from the site of a San Francisco B&B, is that right,
some years ago? Yeah, it was taken from the, in 2010, Banksy came to San Francisco and did 8 paintings. He did one each night. Uh-huh. And this one was done on the side of the Red Victorian Inn, which is on Haight Street in San Francisco.
And you personally removed this piece?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. And so you went on to make a film, Saving Banksy, about just the mystique of this artist.
Well, the mystique of the artist, I think the point of the movie was to try and get people to appreciate street art. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time, 2010, most people still considered this just to be vandalism.
Right.
And the reason I saved this piece and did the movie was, as I said, he would do a piece each night in San Francisco, and the building owners would paint over the paintings within a day or two of Banksy doing them, despite the fact that they'd have 100 people standing in front of their building at any given time taking photos of the painting that had just been put on the side of their building.
Right. I don't know. I'm sure people have told you that there was a little bit of a controversy here with some street art a few years ago. Did you hear about that?
No.
Okay. You'll hear about it. A local street artist got into a little trouble for tagging buildings and public places. So it kind of brings up just the whole controversy over what constitutes art, where should art go? And I think Banksy exemplifies that. And you certainly come down on the side of celebrating his artistry.
Well, I think Banksy's an incredibly important artist just because of the response to what he does. You know, the message behind his pieces and the public reaction to it. You know, of course there's a debate. If you do art on somebody's property without their permission, it's against the law.
Right.
And what's happening is, especially primarily because of Banksy, but also because of Shepard Fairey, and you know, who did the Obama Hope poster in 2008, people started accepting this as a real art form. And you've gone now from artists in 2005, 2006, 2007 doing everything illegally to now 90% of what they do is commissioned by building owners. The building owners pay them. And they're 100% legal walls. So there's much more of a shift towards this being legal and a legal art form, you know, and no longer illegally done.
That's right. And in addition to this piece that you saved, Banksy's piece, this exhibit will also feature work by local street artists. It's called Writing on the Walls.
Right. You know, and the film Saving Banksy was really done to draw attention not to Banksy. Banksy has plenty of attention worldwide, but it's, you know, we featured international street artists. We want people to be aware of this art form. And the purpose of these exhibits, the Rat Travels has been traveling to different cities for 2 years. And one of the requirements that we have is that you showcase the work of local street and graffiti artists. And I'm always blown away, you know, each city we go to with this exhibit of the quality of work mm-hmm. of the local artists, and the work that's exhibited here in Jacksonville is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. We have some real talent here. You know, finally, I have to ask you, do you think he'll ever or she'll ever reveal their identity, Banksy?
I have no idea. You know, and one of the questions I get asked is, do you know Banksy, or have you ever met Banksy? And no, I have not. But, and I'm fortunate that I work with some artists that are friends with Banksy. And the way they describe Banksy is a very shy and quiet person who does not want the celebrity. So my guess is it's doubtful that they'll ever reveal their true identity.
Maybe it's better that way.
I think it's better that way.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, people do need to come out and take advantage of this opportunity to see the work of Banksy. Hate Street Rat is on display now at the Jack's Makerspace Gallery at the Downtown Main Library through April 14th, a $2 million piece of street art also exhibited the work of local street artists called Writing on the Walls. Brian Greif is a street art curator, and he is also a filmmaker. His film is called Saving Banksy, and it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's great to have this work in town. And that is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, Protecting America's Next Election. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.